listen. You can hear their hearts beating loud. Can't keep those California Indians down.
Good evening, everyone. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves County Radio. For Marcus Lopez, Corey Dubin, Fabiana Hirsch, I'm your host for the hour, Larry Smith. On tonight's show, we hear from Candy Mossett of the Indigenous Environmental Network and what transpired at the United Nations Conference on Sustainable Development in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. And in the final segment of today's show, we'll get an update on the implementation of the plurinational state of Bolivia with Catherine Lederber of the Andean Information Network. And now the news. In late last week, about 300 Brazilian indigenous people ended a three-week occupation at one of three work sites of the Belo Monte Dam in the heart of the Amazon rainforest. The Norte Energy Consortium says it will promise to monitor indigenous lands in order to keep outsiders at bay and establish committees to monitor the environmental impact of the dam. If completed, the $11 billion, 11,000-megawatt dam will be the world's third-largest hydroelectric project. The Brazilian government has been trying to complete the project since the 1970s. And in Panama City, the International Whaling Commission has rejected a request from Denmark for a whaling quota for indigenous groups in Greenland. The commission voted 34 to 25 to reject the request for a quota of 1,300 whales over the next 6 years. Last Thursday's vote by the commission comes 2 days after it approved the renewal of the bowhead whale quotas for indigenous subsistence whaling in Alaska and Russia. The 6-year extension was approved by the International Whaling Commission's annual meeting in Panama City. In Canada, members of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation found two grotesquely deformed lesion-covered fish in Lake Athabasca near the community of Fort Chipewyan, Alberta. The suckerfish and jackfish were found on the same day at two separate locations in Lake Athabasca. The indigenous community of Fort Chipewyan is located downstream from Lake Athabasca and one of the most polluting oil operations in the world, the tar sands. And in Anchorage, Alaska, late last week, Penn Air, the only airline with regularly scheduled service to the island village of Sandpoint, banned 15 indigenous community members from the Quaggan Tiangugan Nation from entering Penn Air property in Sandpoint. The ban has in effect left all 15 indigenous community members stranded on the island. Daniel Sabert, Penn Air CEO, posted a letter at the Sandpoint Airport on June 27th naming 15 indigenous people who are not allowed in the Penn Air terminal or the airline property. The only other way off the small Aleutian chain community island, which has a population of 1,000, is a charter taxi or the Alaska Marine Highway System ferry, which sails every other week. The dispute allegedly arose after the indigenous nation filed a lawsuit against Penn Air over a rent dispute, something Penn Air CEO Daniel Sabert has denied. In Northern California, three environmental groups filed a lawsuit to stop a controversial forest-to-vineyard conversion project in the northwest Sonoma County. The proposed land conversion, which is funded by one of the world's largest corporate wineries, Cordonneau SA, would devastate the local forest ecosystem, reduce local water quality, and threaten the endangered coho salmon. The conversion project would also obliterate sacred sites and archaeological sites and diminish the history, identity, and cultural practices of the Kashiapomo Nation. In Kansas, a group of students from Haskell Indian Nations University lost a major court struggle in their battle to save the Wakarusa wetlands, long associated with Haskell history and traditional cultural practices, when the U.S. 10th Circuit Court of Appeals ruled last week that the government's environmental studies were adequate to allow a major highway construction through the wetlands area. The students challenged noise, safety, and other aspects of the government's preferred highway route in South Lawrence, Kansas, and its alleged lack of compliance with the National Environmental Policy Act and related laws. In addition to the students' wetland preservation organization, the Prairie Band, Potawatomi Nation, Sierra Club, and several environmental groups had also objected to the Federal Highway Administration and Kansas Department of Transportation plan to construct a $192 million 6-10 bypass, the South Lawrence Traffic Way, to connect Kansas Highway 10 with Interstate 70. And that concludes the news here on American Indian Airwaves County Radio. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
Governmental school. Well, they're going to educate me to the white man's golden rule. And I'm learning very quickly, for I've learned to be ashamed. And I come when they call me Billy, though I've got a Lakota name.
And that was the song Drums, composed by John Densmore, Keith Sokola, Dave Rowe, Floyd Red Crow Westerman, and Martha Redbone, covering an old Peter LaFarge song called Drums. Candy Mossett is from the Hidatsa, Arikawa, and Mandan Nations and is a member of the Indigenous Environmental Network. She recently returned from the Rio Plus 20 Conference, the United Nations Conference on Sustainable Development in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. The Rio de Janeiro Conference was the largest United Nations conference and was a follow-up to the Kyoto Protocol signed 20 years ago. This is her response to the Rio Plus 20 conference held in Rio de Janeiro from June 13th to June 22nd.
Well, the outcome wasn't surprising to me. A lot of folks have been organizing around these United Nations conferences and gatherings for quite a while. You know, since 1992, we've had all of these different things happening within the United Nations. You know, this is called Rio Plus 20, and the fact that it's plus 20 and things have gotten exponentially worse since the first one just show me that on an international level, unless the United States is willing to take the lead, things aren't going to change the way that we need them to drastically. You know, we're the biggest polluters, regardless of, you know, trying to blame carbon outputs and emissions on China. I still believe the United States is the largest polluters and emitters of pollution in the world. We have to take the responsibility. We have to take the lead. And so as a grassroots organization, the reason that we attend these things is to strengthen and build the grassroots. And while the outcome was not desirable, I mean, essentially things were shelved as far as green economy, which I don't think was neither good nor bad. We didn't want the framework to move forward with a green economy that was dictated by industry, you know, allowing further false solutions like carbon trading. But we also didn't want it completely shelved to say, oh, well, we're just not even going to look at green economy then at all. So it was kind of in not a desirable outcome, but as far as the work we were able to accomplish as the Indigenous Environmental Network, I think it was highly successful. We were able to gather with nearly 500 indigenous folks from all over Brazil. we were able to strengthen the network, strengthen the movement in the sense of the grassroots. And while there still remains to be more strengthening of grassroots folks, I think that it's a step in the right direction.
When you talk about the green economy and the participants at the Rio Plus 20, could you talk a little bit about who exactly those participants were? Because at the same time, the G20 conference was ironically going on about the same time.
Well, before even going into Rio Plus 20, a lot of people had given it a negative stamp, saying nothing is going to happen, there's not going to be a good outcome. And there really wasn't as many heads of state there at Rio Plus 20, so it wasn't as high profile, I guess, as the conference of the parties within the UN that are held every year in November and December. So it wasn't as high profile, and people just sort of said, oh, it's going to be terrible, why even go? But as far as the attendees, I mean, there were people that attended the actual United Nations event itself that were a lot of men in business suits, essentially. I mean, older men in business suits, that's what you saw inside the United Nations. But on the outside, there was the parallel events that were happening as far as the People's Summit and three different indigenous peoples gatherings that were taking place at different times. And that had a lot of the folks that were just very concerned, that are on the front lines dealing with these issues, not only in Brazil but around the world. And for folks like myself and others that came to help build and strengthen the movement, it really was an eye-opening experience, because we hear about things that are happening in the world, news, or listen to it on the radio. But when you're actually there in a country where, for example, things that are happening in Brazil are things that happened in our native communities maybe 100 years ago. So it's an interesting thing to see how we can use our strength together today to try and change the outcomes of how governments are treating their indigenous peoples and grassroots peoples.
Well, you talk about parallel action between what's going on inside the summit and what's going on outside the summit. Before we go into more of outside the summit, I know at the conference, there's only, as you mentioned, there's very few heads of state. I believe the UN reported only 57. Out of the conference came a 50-page document, which seems kind of sparse, but I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about this so-called 50-page document and what was committed, or as I understand, what was more affirmed in terms of past action as opposed to commitment to newer actions.
Well, I mean, basically it was affirmed that within the United Nations they were going to sort of, like I said before, shelve the green economy discussion, mm-hmm. because people weren't happy with the way that it was being defined as a green economy. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they're going to move forward with their same framework that they've been working within, and that's a problem. They want to talk more about sustainability and go back to sort of their original framework. But again, it depends on how they're defining sustainability and who's being allowed to define sustainability. And right now, it's larger countries like the United States, developing countries that want to be like the United States, and it's basically based upon continual growth and capitalism. And that's exactly what we're trying to tell folks, is that that is not sustainable. You cannot expect to grow and grow and grow and take and take and take and treat this entire planet as if it's just a resource to be exploited without there being very negative consequences. And what we're trying to tell folks within these United Nations spaces, at least heads of states and political leaders and people in positions of power, is that the answer to these problems is not continued growth, and it's not money. It's not a money-based economy, and that's the problem within those 50 pages. It's based on a money cash economy that allows continued growth, and that is the problem. We have to get back to a common sense understanding that the earth is not something to be exploited. It's something that will continue to go on with or without humans, but the trajectory that we're on is going to potentially provide us an earth where humans are not able to inhabit it any longer. And that's what that document is upholding. It's an earth that is not inhabitable.
So examples of what you're talking about would be like the United States agreeing to partner with more than 400 companies such as Walmart, Coca-Cola, and Unilever to support efforts to eliminate deforestation by the or from the supply chains by 2020.
But their efforts to eliminate deforestation are under carbon market and carbon trading schemes like REDS. And RED is something that the Indigenous Environmental Network has been fighting against since it first became something that was put on the table. It's a idea. First of all, the acronym stands for Reducing Emissions Through Deforestation and Forest Degradation. It's supposed to be an idea that eliminates deforestation. In fact, what we've seen on the ground in countries like Brazil, in countries like Africa, where there's programs like this on the ground, Ecuador, all these different places where we've seen RED types projects, what the companies do is they literally go into a forest, displace indigenous peoples, basically placing the blame of climate change on them because they have small natural burns and things like that. And they tell people, we will manage your forest for you. And by not cutting down X amount of trees in this country, the United States and other countries that are developing can buy carbon credits to build a new oil refinery, to build a new coal-fired power plant, because they saved the trees in another country. And then the devil is in the details when it comes to RED and RED Plus projects, because literally what they do in some of these countries with these forests is cut down the actual old-growth original forests, and then they plant some type of monocrop like a palm oil to be able to continue to get money. And RED Plus has gone beyond forest. It's going into peat moss. It's going into agriculture. Anywhere that they can say that they are storing carbon and thereby not putting as much into the atmosphere, they are going after it. And it's very scary because it's a false solution. It's definitely something where the United States and other countries are trying to continue capitalism and growth, continue making money without actually addressing the root cause of the problem, which is our use of fossil fuel development. And these projects allow continued use of fossil fuels.
How does this factor into the Millennium Development Goals that was talked about at the summit?
Well, the fact of the matter is, I can't even say it enough, these Millennium Development Goals are not strong enough. The United States has to be able to sign a legally binding international agreement that commits the United States to reducing our consumption and our pollution and our necessity for fossil fuel extraction. We have to take the lead and show other countries that we're serious about climate change. And until the United States does that, these are going to continue to have negative outcomes. And from a personal perspective, I would rather see all of the grassroots folks not going to support a United Nations gathering like this that has continually come with weak outcomes that don't actually address the root causes of the problems. Resources should be put into another gathering like was in Cochabamba, Bolivia, the People's Agreement. I think that it's time for another one of those, and we need to have the grassroots folks really pushing back on the top few percent that ultimately just want to remain in a state where they're comfortable when it comes to money, wealth, and power.
You mentioned Cochabamba, Bolivia. Can you talk about the rights of nature, the mandate by the World's People's Conference in climate change and the rights of Mother Earth?
Well, the idea of the rights of Earth and the rights of Mother Nature go back within indigenous populations for thousands of years. It's the fact that nature itself has jurisprudence. It goes above and beyond any laws that we have put into place today. So it goes above and beyond ownership of land. If a person owns a parcel of land and they have an ecosystem on their land, that ecosystem has the right to thrive and flourish, regardless of who supposedly owns that land. So therefore, other people have the right to defend that ecosystem, regardless of who holds the title, regardless of who the land belongs to, because the earth has jurisprudence, has the right to thrive and flourish over any man-made laws. And so it's basic common sense. It's a principle of human beings not being above anything in the ecosystem, but rather a part of it. There's a cause and effect about the way we live upon this land. And right now, people are just living like zombies in the world, as if they're going to always have water when they turn on the tap. And I think people don't want to hear the view that there could be a day when you turn on the water and there's no tap. And this is in the United States, because this already happens in other countries. And so it has to reach people's consciousness on a whole new level. So the Coach Obama People's Agreement is really a paradigm shift in our thought and the way we live upon the land. It's about living well. I don't want to mess it up. It's about living well, but not necessarily living better.
Living well, but not better than others?
Well, yeah, not even compared to others. It's just living upon the land in the way you need to be, only taking what you need. It's not compared from one person to the next. It's everything. It's living well in your own community in a sustainable way, not necessarily living better, because the quote-unquote American dream has always been to have more and more and more and have successes and riches in a monetary sense. And we've already seen all these studies and problems that people in the United States have faced trying to chase that American dream. The way to live well is to have family around you, to be healthy. It doesn't have to do with how much money you have in your bank account, and that is the paradigm shift we're talking about. No amount of money can bring you the happiness that family, friends, and health around you can.
Earlier you mentioned there was a completely different climate or environment outside the conference, and I know there was some activity with the military, and I was curious, what kind of access did Indigenous peoples have to the summit? Because I know in the past, like at Copenhagen and in 2009, as well as in Durban, South Africa last year, Indigenous people in trying to access the United Nations and this type of conference have had difficulty, if you will.
That's the problem that I'm talking about with these conferences. And that's why personally I think that people should come together to denounce the process as it currently exists, because it's set up for only the people that have power and access and money to be able to go in there. For Indigenous folks of the Amazon, for the people that came all over Brazil, they had no access inside. The people that are being affected the most had absolutely no access. People like myself, coming from North America, who have a bit more privilege and were able to get credentialed, were able to go in, and that to me was the most frustrating thing. We had had Indigenous People's March, where we wanted to deliver the Carioca II statement, and we were simply asking to be able to march down a road that was in front of the building, not even inside the gates, and we were denied access. Almost 500 folks dressed in full regalia were out ready to march, but they were singing and dancing. There was children, there was women. It was a festive mood to be able to come together and prepare our own statement, our own document, highlighting the rights of Indigenous peoples, the rights of Mother Earth and nature. And the military set up a blockade and wouldn't even let us walk down the road to outside the gates of the negotiation. They only let maybe 10 to 15, just a handful of people that were credentialed, actually walk down the road and then get through the gates and then go inside and deliver the statement. And it was really frustrating. It was really disheartening, because the people that should have been granted access the most were the ones that were denied.
I was curious, in terms of the Indigenous people participating or trying to participate, What's the relationship with them and the group of 77?
Yeah, I mean, it just depends on exactly which indigenous groups you're talking about, because in Brazil in particular, it's a very difficult situation in which the government, quite frankly, is very racist against its indigenous populations and has tried at every turn to keep them out of negotiations. In fact, people that had gathered in the indigenous space have prices on their heads for doing the work that they do. There were two fishermen that were washed ashore 3 days after that gathering ended because they were speaking out for fisher people's rights and were leaders of movements in Brazil, and they were killed. And the situation isn't something that can be taken lightly. When people speak out, they're fighting for their very livelihoods, and they're doing it at the risk of their own lives. And it's very difficult to go into other countries and to know that we're working with indigenous peoples and populations that don't have as much access but are willing to stand up and fight for what they know to be right. And so I don't think that they have the level of access, nor do they even have anything close to the level of respect that they deserve. But they still do what they do, knowing that, you know, it's a life or death situation. In the United States, it's a life or death situation for us, but it's in a different context. We're people in my community and our populations are slowly being killed by the industry because of the pollution and the contamination and the ways that we're targeted. And in many ways, it's around the world. The lower income populations are targeted because we don't have the resources that the big corporate giants know that would be easy to fight against. And so that's why reservations in the United States, Native American populations in the United States are targeted, and then indigenous populations, low-income populations in other countries are targeted. That's where the REDS projects are, so that they can build the power plants here in the United States in low-income areas. And it's not something that people don't know about. It's just not something that people like to talk about and acknowledge.
Would a contemporary example of that be the Keystone XL pipeline, which is, you're fully aware of, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers about 2 weeks ago gave the green light to the southern portion of the Keystone XL pipeline project?
Yeah, that could be a contemporary issue, but that affects a lot of people, more than just low-income populations, more than just Native Americans. And that's why I think the rally behind stopping it has been so much louder, because there has been a big force of allies that have been able to come together. People of color, non-people of color, farmers, ranchers, Native Americans, I mean, just a huge amount of people that are being affected that are able to come together in large numbers. I think a better example of the contemporary idea of what's happening in the United States has to do with hydraulic fracturing. For example, I'm living in North Dakota, which is now the second largest oil producing state in the country because of hydraulic fracturing. I'm from Fort Berthold, which is where the Amandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara nations have been placed by the U.S. government. And the Bakken Formation, where all this oil is right underneath our entire reservation, and indeed goes into Canada, Montana. It's a huge formation of oil. And we're being targeted right on the reservation by all kinds of companies with loopholes for environmental regulations. And so we're seeing dumping. We're seeing blue-green algae blooms in our lake like none other before, which are toxic when they're happening. We're seeing ditches on fire, people just putting frack fluids right on the highway. And that would be an example of, again, another population, low-income, being targeted by larger corporate industries. And right now, we're up against a proposed oil refinery to be built on the Fort Berthold Reservation. The Environmental Protection Agency recently just passed the wastewater discharge permit, which we had filed an appeal against, but they passed it. And so as it stands right now, the tribe is getting ready to build an oil refinery, which there hasn't been a new oil refinery built in the United States since 1977.
I know you mentioned hydrofracking, and the documentary Gasland kind of popularized the issue in terms of people being able to, for example, light their water on fire where there's, you know, hydrofracking going on. And I was wondering, in terms of hydrofracking and the energy resource companies continuing to commodify and commit acts of violence against Mother Earth, what role do treaties play in this, or are they just completely being circumvented in this case?
The role of treaties is very important. That's something that the Native and Indigenous populations in North America have that no other population has, and that's our treaty rights. Now we need the ability to uphold them, and the problem that we're seeing in the United States in particular, and in Canada, I guess, too, is that First Nations people, Native American people, are seeing their tribal leaders selling out to the idea of having money, because we have been so oppressed for so many years that when you dangle millions of dollars in front of people and say, now things are going to be better, it's very easy for those political leaders to just say, okay, we're going to sign. And the reason is that they're bullied. I mean, they're basically told, you either take the money, because we're going to come in there and take it anyway. So you either take the money and watch us take it, or you watch us take it and don't get anything at all. At least that's what I'm seeing on Fort Berthold. I can't speak for every place that has hydraulic fracturing, but this is a worldwide problem, too. This is something that is occurring all over the world with basically creating mini bombs underneath the ground, 8,000, 10,000 feet down, creating little earthquakes, fracturing the earth within shale to get out the last bits of natural gas. What's unique about the Bakken Formation in North Dakota is that they're not even worried about the natural gas right now. Almost all of the natural gas is being flared into the atmosphere just to get to the oil. It's all it's about. And why are they doing that? Because the bottom line is that they want money. Rich people want to stay rich. Other people that don't have that much money want to get rich. And it's absolutely absurd to be here in 2012 on the edge of an energy crisis and to know that they are flaring every single day enough natural gas to power 2,200 homes for a year. Every single day, because it's not economically feasible for them to build the pipelines because the price of natural gas is low right now. And so all they're doing is flaring it, going after the oil. And it's not even just abuses to Mother Earth. It's abuses to the native populations here. Our people are sick. There's cancers, asthmas, heart attacks. On all of those rates, are increasing exponentially because of the industry that we've already had in the state of North Dakota. There's 7 coal-fired power plants in this state. There is the nation's only commercial-scale coal-to-liquids, coal gasification plant. We have an oil refinery in this state. We have over 8,000 acres of underground missile sites with nuclear warheads in them that are being protected by the military, but they're here in North Dakota, buried underground, which is very dangerous. We also have over 550 million pounds of pesticides that go into the water every year because we're an agricultural state. I mean, there's uranium mining that's going on here in the western part of the state, and now they're looking to expand the oil development. And so this hydraulic fracturing is an assault on top of everything that we've been dealing with in this state as a result of the fossil fuel extraction in this state. In 2004, the North Dakota State Health Department came out with a study that told people not to eat the large fish because every single bit of our over 11,000 miles of rivers, lakes, and streams is contaminated with mercury. And that's as a result of the 7 coal-fired power plants and the large coal strip mining, so large it can be seen from space. And a lot of people don't know that about North Dakota. And all they know about North Dakota right now is that there's low unemployment because of this oil boom. But they don't talk about the extreme negative impacts we're already seeing on the environment. Decreases in yields of crops, that the crops that help feed this country are seeing decreases in yields. The water used to grow those crops is being contaminated, and people are moving out if they can afford to because of how disastrous it is to drive around on the roads here. On Fort Berthold alone, over the past 3 years, we've had 7 young people killed because of the semi-trucks on these roads. And these are people that are between the ages of 3 years old and 30 years old. And that's only the ones on Fort Berthold that are in that age range. It doesn't include others that are older than that or others that are off the reservation. And those are just traffic accidents from the semis on the road.
There's a lot of things you say that bring up parallel situations from the past, but back home, have we reached a degree in intensity of, and even an occurrence of, say, the forced relocation of Diné or Navajo people in the 1970s because of Peabody Coal Company's dubious activities, wanting to access the largest bed of low sulfur bituminous coal under the Hopi and Diné Nations lands.
As the Indigenous Environments Network, we also work with Black Mesa Water Coalition, who was formed by a group of youth to fight against Peabody Coal, and they have been having successes in the past. As far as shutting down Peabody Coal and getting their permits overturned, but it's been a hard uproad battle because a lot of the own people, the Diné and people that are living there, Hopi people, had jobs within these companies, and so it felt like people were taking their jobs away, and that's ultimately what the companies used as a way to keep people on their sides, is the job factor, the money factor. And the irony in all of this is that we have the ability to use alternative sources of energy systems that won't pollute the environment and continue to exploit the earth. But the companies are used to business as usual. They're used to the money that's rolling in because of coal, because of oil. But in Arizona, there is a ton of sunlight. There's the ability for solar power. In North Dakota, we're the windiest state in the country, North Dakota alone has enough wind power potential to power one-third of the entire country's energy needs. And this year, the funding for that type of renewable energy was cut back. So it's not about not having the ability to make it happen. It's the will to make it happen by politicians within the people that are in the positions of power. And so Indigenous communities are trying to come together in a way that shows people that there is an answer to obviously live upon this land. We also hear all the time, what are the alternatives? If, for example, if they don't build the Keystone XL pipeline, what's the alternative? Because there has to be an alternative. There has to be something. And it's so funny because as Indigenous peoples, we just laugh and say, we didn't have pipelines for thousands of years and really upon the land. And in the last 200 years since the Industrial Revolution, look at how much death and destruction has been caused. Listen. That's what we try to push and tell people. There is a way to live. It's just not the way that is being led right now as far as fossil fuel extraction and exploitation of the earth. People's way of thinking, European, I guess, ways of thinking, are not fundamentally, they're fundamentally flawed. There is no way that we can continue to live thinking that nature and earth is something to be exploited and expect to be living here as humans a few hundred years from now. It's just not going to happen. We have to get back to the very basic common sense principle that all things are connected. It sounds kind of cliche in this day and age, but there's a hard truth and reality to the fact that there has to be a balance to everything, and because there is cause and effect. And unless human beings take responsibility to change the idea that we need to exploit the earth on a whole level, like on a political level, on a higher level of people in positions of power, unless those people change, their ideologies. We're headed toward a place, like I said before, that is uninhabitable for the human population. The Earth itself is going to go on. That I have no doubt of. It's just what kind of state it's going to be in and what kind of state we're going to drive it to be in as the way we live upon this land continues to get worse and worse and people get greedier and greedier.
I know we are short on time and you have to go, and I want to close with asking you about a particular human being that was instrumental in defending and protecting Mother Earth and protecting Indigenous people's fundamental human rights. And with this last minute or so, I was wondering if you could talk about this individual who recently moved on.
Sure, yeah. It's still really difficult to talk about because Pat was a really good friend. I can talk about him because I don't want people to forget him. I don't want people to forget his name and who he was and what he did. Pat Spears was from Lower Brule. He was an amazing person who was so kind-hearted and was able to just go into a room and talk common sense to people in a way that felt right. He was the president and co-founder of the Intertribal Council on Utility Policy and worked on renewable energy systems through wind, largely, and had also been working with straw bale building demonstrations. He and Bob Goff, was one of his partners, were able to just make amazing things happen for several years throughout Indian country and did it in the face of so much backlash and people saying, no, you can't do this, you can't make this happen. And I suppose about a year ago or so, he was diagnosed with liver cancer, which many people didn't know about and maybe still don't know about. But he kind of kept it to himself, and he just kept working. Even though he was really sick, he worked up until about 3 months ago when he just couldn't go anymore. And so it was really difficult to lose him because he was somebody that a lot of us could look up to as a mentor and as a person who, no matter what, in the face of adversity, would never give up.
The ones who love you, stay by your side. They watch, they pray, they show you the way every day. They bring heaven closer to you.
People we love go back home. Not alone. Somehow they're with us. For love never dies. They watch, they pray, they show us the way. Every day,
every day,
they bring heaven closer to me than you.
And that was Candy Mossett of the Indigenous Environmental Network here on American Indian Airwaves County Radio. And in the final segment of today's show, we go to County Radio's Corey Dubin with Cochabamba, Bolivia.
Pleasant good evening, and we're pleased to be joined by a regular contributor here, Catherine Lettaber. She is the director of the Andean Information Network.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Catherine, Teepnis 2, we like to call it up here. The marchers are in and around La Paz. Give us a feel for what's happening.
It was certainly a great relief that there was no brutal police intervention on the roadway. But at the same time, it's very frustrating to see that there wasn't an openness on the part of the Morales administration to dialogue directly with the marchers. They refused to speak with the groups who had traveled in winter weather with 300 children to have their demands heard. The government bust in many authorities and groups that opposed the march and were never really willing to take on or address the marchers personally. I think this is a very sad event. I think that it's very unfortunate that there wasn't the ability to establish dialogue. I thought it was very unfortunate that the Bolivian security forces tear gassed and used anti-riot water Neptune cars to disperse the marchers repeatedly. In the end, marchers decided to return back to their communities of origin. At the same time, there was a very questionable movement, a hastily called election of CIDOB, the Bolivian Eastern Indigenous Confederation, in which new authorities and leaders were elected that were against the marchers and support the road through Tibni. So I think that it's unfortunate that there appears to have been a very clear process of divide and conquer. Obviously, the support for or against the road was always very divided, and there were a myriad of different groups with conflicting interests there. But I think it becomes clear at this time that the Morales administration is using strategies or tactics to really actively block the process. And there's doubt remaining about how this consultation, supposed prior consultation that the government has mandated, that's scheduled to begin on July 29th. It's not clear if that's going to move forward. The Bolivian Constitutional Tribunal ruled last month that the measure was constitutional, but that it could only go forward if consensus existed on the methods and the way the questions were formulated. So I think the Morales government feels it's a victory that they didn't engage with the marchers. The marchers didn't gain what they had hoped, but yet we haven't made any progress in terms of dialogue or reaching consensus, and we haven't seen the Morales administration at this point in time show very much skill at balancing different interests or negotiating to come to some sort of acceptable middle ground.
Catherine, as you're talking, one thing comes to mind. President Morales is playing hardball, and I wonder, given the stakes, is it the need to move the natural gas, to finance the MAS program? What's driving him to play such what I would call intense hardball?
I think that there are interests in terms of natural resources. I think that there's a lot of pressure from Brazil for the completion of the highway. I think that there's a Brazilian interest beyond that of having a road go through, or the economic interests of OAS, their construction company, but also a desire to have easy entry into Bolivia for Brazilian mass-produced goods. At the same time, you know, there are many groups that support the road that hope that it will bring greater progress. It's not clear what's motivating Morales here, but there certainly has been, I think, an inability to genuinely step back and create an environment in which there can be a consultation or that there's some sort of agreement can be met. Because what we've seen throughout this process and the insistence of the Morales administration or the steps that it has taken, some very calculated, others unwitting, is that it has not brought the different groups closer together. But instead, it has really created greater polarization, greater bitterness, and greater potential for conflict. And I think this is something that's very, very worrisome at a time where conflicts continue to erupt and circulate throughout the country. I'm very frustrated at this, at what I feel like is an issue that has generated so much negative interest, energy. It has generated so much attention and highlighting kind of the inherent contradictions, one in the challenges Morales faces, but in the promises he has made and his decision to present himself to the world as an indigenous president. I think that some of these problems were unavoidable, but the way that this conflict has evolved and deteriorated highlights really a lack of skill to reach or reconcile such extreme differences of opinion, and I think this is deteriorating support for him. At the same time, other conflicts have had more lamentable results. It really depends on how you look at it in terms of the Mayaku Cota conflict with the South American Silver Corporation, something that has been in the news for the last couple of weeks and unfortunately led to the death of one protester last week.
Catherine, I want to move towards the Potosí and the Canadian Mining Company, but one question in between. Does this damage the drive to a plurinational state?
It damages the drive towards a plurinational state, but it also highlights that the road to a plurinational state is not easy. It's filled with obstacles. It's filled with contradictions. It's filled with diverse peoples who have needs and interests that aren't always complementary. And the difficulty of a goal that is lost and necessary, at the same time, it's a frustration or a roadblock that I think Morales has made even worse for him, his government, and for all Bolivians.
Well, and it seems, Catherine, like in the Potosí situation with South American Silver, another big Canadian mining company, is more of what we're seeing in El Salvador and elsewhere, very large North American, Canadian, and American, and European for that matter, mining companies really pushing the envelope. And yet I see that the Morales administration really denied that there was any conflict out there.
Well, it's frustrating. The Morales administration certainly denied that they had any responsibility in the death of the protester, Jose Mamani Mamani. The role of South American Silver has been seriously questioned, but at the same time, there are inherent conflicts in mining and between miners in Norte de Potosí. It's a region in which there is a difference of opinion between miners who work for Comibol, the state mining company, and are subcontracted to South American Silver, and independent freelance miners who work sometimes with permission and sometimes not, and historical differences and frictions between the IUs, the community in that region, have all fed into a conflict that has been grossly exacerbated by the role of South American Silver, a lack of honesty, the participation of their employees, you know, who dressed in traditional clothing of the region to photograph and provide surveillance on community meetings. This is a concession that was granted before the election of Morales. It's one of South American Silver's main projects, but it also becomes clear that there was a great deal of gold in the region that South American Silver hadn't informed about. During the conflict, this very complex conflict between communities, between miners, all seeking to guide their guarantee their livelihood, South American Silver has been very misleading, and the Morales government on several occasions about the incidents. One, there were four protesters who received gunshot wounds. A fifth man apparently died from a bullet wound to the nape of the neck. Unfortunately, Bolivian government minister Carlos Romero discounted the death of the protester, obviously from a gunshot wound, by using a traditional Bolivian right-wing excuse. I think the notion that the community member who was clearly shot died as a result of his own drunken negligence is something that is a really reprehensible characterization. And the next day, the Bolivian government stated that only the autopsy on Mamani Mamani's body would show the true cause of death. Obviously, someone who has blown themselves to bit with dynamite is not able to be autopsied. And so we have still a denial of human rights violations. The government eventually agreed to pay the widow approximately $1,100, something that is in no way a replacement for judicial consequences or in any way a substantial financial easing of her burdens. Eventually, an agreement was reached in which they the Morales administration decided to nationalize South American silver's holdings, that they would be run by Comibol. They also made a series of agreements to facilitate the legal process against one of the community leaders, Cancio Rojas. There was a liberation of the hostages that were taken by anti-South American silver community members, an agreement that there would be a community justice verdict for their role in surveillance of the community, specifically the construction of 1,000 adobe houses sometime in the near future. And so this has brought an end to a conflict, created a lot of friction with South American Silver, a company that had grossly misinformed about their holdings in the area, grossly misinformed about their activities, misinformed their shareholders and the general public about the situation there, and specifically about the death of the protester at a point in time where it becomes clear that this was a result of a police action. So I think that it's important for people to understand how the actions of these companies tend to play on or exacerbate pre-existing differences, and how the focus of these companies is very profit-oriented with very little sensitivity to the negative impact that their work creates for the peoples that are living in the region.
The moment of silence is over.
And that was Catherine Lederber of the Andean Information Network here on American Indian Airwaves Coyote Radio. That concludes our show for today. Special guest for the hour, Candy Mossett of the Indigenous Environmental Network and Catherine Lederber of the Andean Information Network. Music for today's show was Aragon Stars, California Indians, and John Densmore, Keith Sokola, David Rowe, Floyd Red Crow Westerman, and Martha Redbone covering the Peter Lafarge song, Drums. Profane, Eric Bibbs covering People Love You, and our outgoing track was performed by the band Blackfire, the song Uprising. Today's show is mixed and mastered in the studios of Coyote Radio in Goleta, California, and Burnt Swamp Studio in Signal Hill. American Indian Airwaves broadcast on KPFK, FM 90.7 Los Angeles, FM 98.7 Santa Barbara, FM 93.7 North San Diego, and FM 99.5 in Ridgecrest, California, and in Columbus, Ohio on FM 103.1. For Marcus Lopez, Corey Dubin, Fabiana Hirsch, I've been your host for the hour, Larry Smith. Until next time. Forever.